You can listen aloud.
Okay.
He'll still he'll get it.
Starting with which word?
Mishnah.
The Mishnah or the Gemara?
Mishnah, ve'ein lokchin. All right. We're studying in Masechet Gittin. We're doing the chapter about Tikkun Olam and fixing the world.
Mm-hmm. Which, excuse me, 40?
45, oh yes, but hold on one second, I'll tell you which of the bees.
See, it's a matter of timing. Tikkun Olam. I couldn't speak a better Hebrew.
Right, Tikkun Olam.
45. B.
We didn't do that? I think we did it. I'm putting Tashbuyim.
No, the Ein Lokchin. 45A4 is where it starts. Sorry.
45A4?
Yeah, it's the very end of the daf on page 45A.
Ah, okay, yes. The Ein Lokchin Sfarim.
Ein Lokchin Sfarim.
Okay.
And we are going to see, first of all, that we're going to deal with more stories about what idolaters take from us. Idolaters in the Masechta, in this chapter in the tractate, were already part of the landscape of Jewish experience at this time. What they did in our chapter is they acquired, or they were given, or they were known as having different status. Of course, a Jewish person doesn't marry a non-Jewish person, to the rabbis here. Of course, in this chapter, there is the fluidity of identity as well, and that is that non-Jewish Canaanite slaves who are on their way to becoming full citizens of Israel and Jewish can count to the minyan and then can become eligible for marriage. There is the instance where idolaters take women and hold them hostage. There are incidents where animals are taken by the non-Jewish community. We see that there are instances where sages are imprisoned and held for ransom. That's what we just did last time we met, and we talked about those instances. So these kinds of relations could go one of two ways. Either you could feel very open and make an entree, make a gateway for people to actually become part of the Jewish people, or you can make sure that you understand who you're dealing with, and those people who are not Jewish and have the status of being idolaters, you have to understand what you can and can't do in terms of a relationship with them, in terms of business, a relationship with them in terms of marriage, a relationship with anyone from the community in terms of when they steal or take or hold captive and try to ransom back. And so we're at one of those moments where we have idolaters who are stealing and taking and ransoming back. So important are Torah scrolls, mezuzahs, and tefillin that they are included in the chapter where idolaters might steal a person, might kidnap a person and ransom a person, where idolaters might take your livestock, where idolaters might hold one of your sages in captivity for ransom, and where idolaters take a Torah scroll, a mezuzah, or tefillin. So when we think about what's being equated here in terms of importance in the community, I don't think we have to necessarily think about it in terms of equivalence, by the way. But we can say, here is a ranking of very important kinds of items that might be ransomed that we're going to have to figure out whether or not we're going to, A, come up with the money, B, once we do come up with the money, what are we going to do with these items if they have a different status now that they've been kidnapped, they've been taken, or see what kind of discussion can we have in terms of the way we see the world in relationship to these others whom we're calling other in our worldview and in our physical location, where we live, near where we live. And it's going to be an interesting discussion that we're going to get into vis-a-vis some of the Gemara we're about to get into after the Mishnah, as to what kind of rules and laws come about as they relate to non-Jews and Torah scrolls and tefillin. That's where they're going to take the conversation. And this is, I should say up front, the famous location, you know, Hamakom, Hamakor, the source for a lot of the halachists who go on to think about who is kosher for writing Torah scrolls. Okay, so that's going to be a little bit of what we'll investigate over here. And I brought some also show and tell because we're talking about very real objects, religious objects, and there's a reference to fixing them, and I wanted to show you a little bit. Okay, so let's go into the Mishnah. Mishnah, bottom of the page. Mem Hei Aleph. Ve'ein lokhin sfarim tefillin u'mezuzot. One may not buy Torah scrolls, tefillin or mezuzot, min ha'ovdei kochavim, from idolaters. Yoter al kedei demehen, for more than their value. So, if I was just reading the Mishnah and it didn't say Yoter al kedei demehen, for more than their value, what might I have been able to think in terms of a general rule that I was getting?
Don't do business with them.
Lekach, mekach, mekach u'memkar. So mekach u'memkar is the way we say business, and so lokhin, the verb, is actually a verb that I might have just thought was a natural verb for business. So that's fine. Ve'en lokhin sfarin tefillin u'mezuzot min ha'ovdei kochavim. If I was just trying to define a relationship with idolaters, but Yoter al kedei demehen, for more than their value comes along to say, oh, wait a minute, what do you mean for more than their value? What is that adding here? That's adding the premise here that they're demanding from me more than their value. Maybe, again, it's just business, and that's the way that they're doing it because they feel like they can demand or command a higher price. But really it clues us into the reality that they're talking about those that were stolen from the Jewish people.
Quick question. Steinwald says min ha'goyim, not ovdei kochavim. So why is that?
He writes that in the Hebrew?
Yep. The body of the text.
Oh, so that's an interesting feature to point out for a minute. You're right. I didn't notice the difference in the Hebrew. Steinsaltz that Meir is using is the Israeli Steinsaltz full out in the Hebrew. And this is the Steinsaltz that is the new Steinsaltz English Hebrew.
The new one?
Yeah. So that's the Israeli version, all Hebrew. And this is the new Steinsaltz project. Okay, so you have...
So how did the Goyim become... why
I'll tell you. What's interesting is that the this gets into a story, I won't go through the whole story, but bottom line is, Steinsaltz brought back the original text that uses the word goyim. The Vilna, the page in front of us, is in some ways a self-censored text. Because the printings of the Talmud that the new printing houses wanted to sell needed to have words that the expurgators were not going to come around and demand get crossed out, let alone collect them like in the end of the 13th century Paris and burn all the Talmuds in the public square. It has everything to do with the sense of the word goyim that the censors and expurgators through papal decrees must get rid of in Jewish texts.
I'm sorry, say that again?
The church in the early 1500s begins to completely censor and expurgate texts. Okay? The, one of the words that really offends them is goyim.
Goyim.
And
thank you.
Of course, this word goy, we've talked about it before in terms of the Tanakh, can simply mean nation. But many times you sense already that it's a word that creates otherness. And that word, in terms of the church policy, in terms of any censorship and then post-printing expurgation, becomes the word that might stop you from selling a very nice set of Gemara in your locale if the local authority is going with the, like, let's say, more extreme position of just collect all those Talmuds that were printed with those words goyim and get them off the shelves. And by the way, we're going to figure on burning them.
But the Ovdei Kochavim was not their replacement, was not the substitute. Couldn't
so,
because that's even worse than goyim, no?
Yeah, but the goyim was against the kohavim.
Not to the church.
Seriously.
So the church knows about the word goyim?
So, others being of the kohavim was better than goyim?
So here's why.
Idolaters is better than goyim.
Here's why. Listen to this amazing reality. The church defines itself in a certain way as a goy kadosh, as a holy nation.
Right.
But they're in no way idolaters. The
no,
church
yeah, no.
The church is not an idol-worshipping religion. The church's religion is not idol worship. Therefore, if I write in Ovdei Kochavim into my text, I'm obviously not talking about the Christian church, the Catholics. And remember, what they really are concerned about is that there's this utter rejection and the sense of being cast as totally other in a world that they are inhabiting church power, right? Lateran councils, all this kind of burgeoning church power and hegemony that the empire takes on as the Holy Roman Empire, and it kind of flows in and out, say from the years 650, 700, in through the Middle Ages, in through the centuries, 1400s, 1500s. It's really a struggle. And they need to make sure that among the Jews, it doesn't really happen. Comes printed books, Jewish scholarship, blossoming rabbinic Jewish presence in Europe. Printing press, runs of 1,000 Talmudim at a time. Three runs of the Talmud, 3,000 books, incredible new technology in the marketplace of Europe. And the church is not only dealing with the Jewish rebellion of the truth that they're seeking of the Bible in the Talmud, but they're also dealing with the rebellion of who? The Protestants around them.
Yeah. Ah, that's true.
They have every reason to say about the Jewish people, we want you to come and understand what you're missing here.
Ah.
We're all part of the same faith, really. The truth is in the way we interpret Isaiah's vision of the Savior. The truth is in the way we are one nation, holy, you and me. Really, the church could be saying to the local community of Italy, it would just be a nice feather in our cap if you guys would just come and convert to Catholicism. with their censorship and expurgation. That's the nutshell of the narrative that's coming out in the new scholarship concerning these church censors, expurgators, Hebraists. If it wasn't for some of the Hebraists, we wouldn't have had these books, because maybe they would have burned them all, as the culture would have become a burning culture instead of a culture where we saved books and censored them or expurgated them later. So it's this interplay. Steinsaltz, I noticed this before in the Steinsaltz translations and Hebrew text. He goes back to using some of the terminology also for Jesus, who's mentioned in several Masechtot, where that was also expurgated and then self-censored by those wishing to make sure that they could sell the Talmud, either tractate by tractate or set of Talmud as they came. So, fascinating piece of reality staring us in the face between the two Gemaras on the table.
So,
I was wondering, because the Mishnah starts off with you can't buy from these, whether or not it's Christian or idol worshippers, but wouldn't that be obvious? That you would need, I mean, this whole thing about how Tefillin is supposed to be written and how everything a mezuzah is supposed to be done, that you would think it's obvious that you wouldn't be buying it for someone that's not Jewish or Orthodox.
It's really a great kind of Hava Amina that you're saying, right? In the Talmud, we say, here's the Hava Amina, Hava Amina. Isn't it that we would say simply on its face that no way we don't buy scrolls and we don't buy tefillin from anybody else other than the Jewish sofrim, the Jewish scribes? Doesn't exactly work that way. Because the Hava Amina already is that somehow either they're holding it hostage and we have to ransom it, or maybe, as the conversation will unfold, you will see.
Printing press and all the other things.
No, but we're much earlier than that.
Yeah.
And maybe there are some who write the scrolls themselves. First of all, if they are early Christians, they're writing the scrolls because they still learn those same books. Secondly, there might be those who read those scrolls because they are comparing their own philosophy to them. And thirdly, there might be those who are copying from scrolls that they had created for themselves into other languages and trying to sell them to people who want, from the scribal traditions in the land of Israel, translations of those books. So we have a lot of reasons to see not a huge industry of scroll making, but enough of an industry where more than just Jews are writing scrolls.
Yes, my question is regarding your diversification. We cannot call the Christian goyim anymore because they are not idolaters. So what do you call...
The word goyim does not necessarily mean idol worshiper.
No, but goyim means non-Jew, usually.
And so you can. So we still, we say we're a goy kadosh. We refer to ourselves as a goy kadosh in the Sidur. So we still use the word as nation. It just simply means nation. Okay, and why do we not do this? Mipnei tikkun olam. For the benefit of society. Now, we don't take them for more than they're worth for the benefit of society. Why? Economic reasons. Same reason, one of the same reasons why we got into the last time. If I have a very serious and important set of scrolls in my local synagogue or even in my home, I have my own collection. And they're taken and they're ransomed back to us because we use them for learning, we use them for ritual. And I'm willing to pay more than everybody else is at risk of really paying the higher price to the people who steal and take these books or scrolls. And I can't go to my local sofer and just pay the price. Or I could just go to the local sofer and pay the price and not worry about that one that this one ransoms. Now, you can get attached to a scroll. And sometimes people in their, you know, material possession reality get attached to certain items and how you inherit it and who writes it and all this. But what it's really saying is that don't start inflating the market where people take these and try to sell them back to you. Just get a replacement so that we don't economically really inflate the market. And that in and of itself might just be the tikkun olam that's discussed here. I'm going to leave open the possibility that early strata of the Mishnah or teachings might not have included all parts of the Mishnah, as radical as that sounds. And the Ein Lokhin Tzfarim Tfilin Umizuzot Min HaOvdei HaKochavim or Min HaGoyim Yoter Al Kadei Demehen, period, didn't have Mivnei Tikkun Olam. We didn't say for the fixing of society and the, let's say, equitable distribution of resources, do we deal with this issue of buying back Torah scrolls of tefillin. This Mishnah might have simply been about whether or not we do business and pay a higher price to someone who's not Jewish. And, by the way, we might have wanted to pay a higher price because of what? Because of the beautiful handwriting. Because of the different kind of parchment. Because of
Chilul HaKodesh, you don't want it to be in other people's hands. That's not important.
So that gets back to what Ari was saying. That is true. It might just be for the sense that you don't want to take it from somebody else. But then why for more than their value?
Yeah.
Because if I only had a lochinotam, then I can understand. Because you don't take them from Ovdei Kochavim or Min HaGoyim. And now the Gemara makes sense to me, where it's going to expand the list of who I can buy from and who I can't buy from. And it could be exactly, Ron, Aryeh, that I didn't have that little part either, Yoter Al Kadei Demehen. Maybe it was only simply the lesson, I don't buy my Torah, my tefillin, and my mezuzahs from non-Jews.
True.
And the reality there stands in and of itself as an area of law that I might be able to say, period, the end. Then I add, don't buy them for more than they're worth. And then I have a whole different kind of situation where I can say, maybe they were taken, and then they're ransomed back. And then I have a whole different kind of principle of law that I want to apply to this lesson or these sets of rules, and I say it's for tikkun olam because I'm realizing that my development of the tikkun olam is really about what? The expectation that you're going to have some kind of economic system in place that does not necessarily lean on the community to pay extra for anyone's sentimental article, Klei Kodesh,
what we call Klei Kodesh.
We don't want to inflate the price of these things. So there's all kinds of possibilities. Mira.
This reminds me of how the Dead Sea Scrolls were bought.
Ah.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yes,
right?
Yes. Tell the story in your own,
well,
in your own words.
It was discovered by the Bedouin young guys at the Qumran case, and some dealer, no, some dealer bought it from them. And there was a little ad in the Wall Street Journal, a little ad, this size, 2x2, that it was for sale. And I think the father of Igal Yadin, Sukenik, the father, someone saw it. And they wanted a hefty price. And they approached the State of Israel, the government, to pay for that. And they did. Mm-hmm. So it was a very hefty price, but it was beyond any monetary value, and that's how we have the Dead Sea Scrolls.
That was in the 40s, right? I mean, when they were discovered.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
40s.
Well, the government or a provisory government, but it was the state paid for that. So it's not a ransom, but it's like you can charge anything.
Right.
And it was, they knew that it was beyond any monetary value, and we have the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Beyond any monetary value. Yes.
You can, if you Google that, you can still find that little ad. I have it in one of my files, that ad, the Wall Street Journal,
And this, exactly like the word from that day, from the newspaper, it was for sale. And one linguistic observation about the Lokhin, because you mentioned Mikacho and Kar, it occurred to me, I never thought about it until this minute, that to bargain in Hebrew is lehitmakeach.
Mekach.
The verb, lehitmakeach. So it's the same root, which is interesting. I never thought about putting the two words together, lakacha, to take, and to bargain.
Oh, yeah.
It's the same word.
Oh, yeah.
Lehitmakeach.
But what Meir is pointing out is this wonderful phrase in Hebrew about doing business is to both, right, take and bargain. A back and a forth.
Yeah.
Mekach humemkar. Mekach is mem kufchet,
right.
Right? But there's a fallen lamed. It's not makach.
It's
a
lamed
fallen
lamed.
Lamed.
Dagesh. The lamed, the
right.
Missing lamed can
so
be.
So that's
dagesh.
Why there's a dagesh in
Malkoch. The lamed is there replaced by a dagesh, possibly. You know what I'm
saying?
So talking about?
Yeah. So we have a replacement of the lamed. That verb lakach. And memkar is to sell, so you have the give and the take of the selling and the buying, and the I'll take it for this, and no, I'll take it for this. So there's a sense of the two parties by having the two-word expression as well. Some of these ancient expressions that have two words recognize that there's kind of like contract law says there are two parties that have to be engaged, right? So let's go into the Gemara. Let's see where this goes. Where the rabbis take it. All right, the Gemara is now going to talk about the Torah scroll found in possession of the idolater. And it's going to ask, what can we do with this Torah scroll? Because that's really, Lamase, what we have to figure out. We're just now assuming that he's got it in his possession, and we're taking it, we're getting it, but okay, we're going to have differences of opinion about what you now can do with that scroll. Amar le Rav Budia le Rav Ashi. So Rav Budia says to Rav Ashi, Yater al kadei demehen hu de'ein lokhin. It is for more than their value that we may not buy Torah scrolls. He says, oh, for more than their value, we don't buy them. Ha, b'yichadei d'meihen lochin. But for no more than their value, we may buy them. If they're charging the price that they're worth, then obviously you can buy them because the Mishnah said only when it's above their price, it's beyond the price that they're worth, we don't buy them. But it must mean that when they're invalued properly, that we can take them. Shema mina. So what is it that we really learn from this? That you can buy it for the price that it's worth, but you can't buy it if it's too much. I must have to learn something from that. Sefer Torah Shenimtza V'yad Oved Kochavim, a Torah scroll found in the possession of an idolater, Korinbo, you can read from it. You can study from it. So the Gemara wants to know whether it's fit for use. What's the fit for use possibility for a Torah scroll at this stage? There are really two areas. One is that really the scroll is for learning and studying. And another is that the scroll is really used for the public reading of Torah. Mm-hmm. So I have two possible uses, and we're not sure, by the way, and you could start a good conversation here. Is it korinbo, meaning you read the public reading from it, and not necessarily Talmud Torah, because I don't have the specific mitzvah of Talmud Torah actually mentioned here? This is just a question from the outside that I'm bringing to the text. Or can I do both? I'm not really sure. I think you can make an argument that it's either or both.
When does the public reading of the Torah start?
Public reading of the Torah starts really when the Jews are, through the edict of Cyrus the Great, allowed back to the land of Israel, and in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, In the book of Ezra, you have the public square filled with men, women, children, and all the elders, and they open the scroll and they read.
580, 540.
So at some point in that big construction project, the synagogue culture of public reading is built. It's affirmed in the Talmud text, in the Mishnah and the Talmud, that says you should go no more than 3 days without Torah reading, so that you're not thirsty in the desert.
Mm-hmm.
You need mayim, you need, what's mayim, what's water in our tradition?
Torah.
Mm-hmm.
And you should read Mondays, Thursdays, and Sabbaths.
You know, this whole area of the business of buying the scroll back is just showing that at that time, if we will analyze a supply and demand, they really didn't have supply. Because if there was a great supply, the thieves would not get the price they want. The problem is that the production of the Torah scroll at that time was such in a slow pace. That is why it caused to pay, everyone paid over the price, because otherwise you wouldn't get the scroll back, or any scroll. That's
okay.
What it shows, that the supply demand was less supply, more demand, or just less supply.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a different philosophy here. The philosophy is you should not pay more than it's worth.
Yeah, but if you don't have any other source, you pay what you need.
No, but we are saying this is what the scriptures are saying. We should not pay more than...
Okay, so don't buy food for your kids if you don't have...
No, it's saying that some people did it, and therefore they're trying to adjudicate the matter. Really, philosophically, the philosophy about it all is, on the one hand, philosophy. The other piece is... The other piece is there's real business going on here, and that's why all the pieces are put together. And the piece of business that's going on here is that isn't it interesting that, not first of all, non-Jews would take scrolls and ransom them back, and secondly, again, getting into the Gemara before we're there, is there an industry of non-Jews who are writing Torahs and tefillin and scrolls? So that's the interesting part of this, that we would have expected philosophically that it's only from us. But there's more to be said about that issue. And we're in that sugya now. I'd like to just continue along, if you don't mind.
Please.
Because I want to get to the pieces of text.
Also? Like written by Goy, counterfeit?
No.
I don't think we're talking about counterfeiting right now.
No. We're talking about top quality craftsmen who were non-Jews, who well-off Jews wanted to use.
That's what I think.
And that's
more
pretty
than
common throughout all of history, but that's what we're talking about.
The Gemara rebuts the proof, though. Dilma lignos. Perhaps when you get such scrolls, you can't use them for either studying or reading in public. Perhaps you need to lignosotam, to put them in a geniza. In other words, to bury them at this stage. We don't necessarily think that there's a little building like the one in Cairo, on top of a shul or a room in a shul, that you buried, you hid the scrolls away. So regardless of how beautiful or whether the kashrut of them, the sentimental value you had, if they were by another people and they were held ransom and they sold them back to you, even at their value, what's the point for this possibility, the dilma in the Gemara? Here is the philosophy come to light. You cannot use them because somehow we need them to be Jewish and not from these non-Jews or even having had them in their hands, and therefore we need to bury them. Now the Gemara is going to discuss the legal status of Torah scrolls written by someone other than a believing Jew, according to the way that Art Scroll says it, and there's no kind of introductions of Rav Nachman in the Steinsaltz where it qualifies it, but we'll see if that sense that we're talking about non-believing Jews is the right idiomatic introduction from the Art Scroll. Amar Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman says the following, Nikitinan, we have a tradition that says the following, Sefer Torah Shekitavo, mean a Torah scroll written by someone who we categorize as a mean, Yisaref, should be burned. Kitavo Oved Kohavim, one written by an idolater, Yiganez, you should just bury it and put it away. Now I have two differentiated, results under the law for a scroll written by a mean and a scroll written by an idolater. Now, what is a mean? Nice note in the Steinsaltz version of the Gemara says the following: it is assumed that a Jewish heretic, which was the term used in the Talmud for Christians, would have idolatrous intent when writing a Torah scroll. Ah, so now I'm going to revamp what I told you before, waiting for this moment to tell you more about the language. Maybe the word goyim, really was the word for idolater.
Right.
And not necessarily Christian, because I have a different word for Christian.
Rashi says komer. Mean, Rashi translates mean to be a komer.
Well, Rashi translates mean to be...
which is an Orthodox...
Right, right here.
An Orthodox word.
Mean... Duk Davuda Zara Kigon Komer.
Orthodox Christian.
Right. Yeah. Right.
So Christians are not going.
Mean.
Yep. Mean.
Ha Iduk Ba Avodat Kochavim, those who are engaged in idol worship, Kigon Komer. As in
priest. Komer is a priest.
As in a
Christian priest.
As in a priest. So you could say here, by way of the Rashi, that we have to know what a Komer really is and does in the time of Rashi to really understand Rashi. So what by his time are priests doing?
They were writing the Bible.
They were using all kinds of incense, but moreover, they were embodying, right? They were embodying Jesus in the wine and through the wafer, bread, the body and the blood. And Rashi does not yet come from a tradition in Europe that is later affirmed entirely by other of the Rishonim. Rashi we call a Rishon, but we call other folks who come after him still in that period up to the time when we start the later stages, the Achronim. But the end of the period of the Rishonim affirms that what? The Catholics and Christianity is begader hadat in the boundaries of the monotheistic faith. So he might be, by using this word, trying to link the Avodat Kohavim, the idolatry he mentions, with
the
Christian worship that he sees
in Europe.
Medieval France, Ashkenaz. Incredible moment of like trying to see Rashi in his own element there, right? Back to the Gemara's language. The Gemara, now we have three words. We have goyim, we have min, and we have ovdei kohavim. So we just have to keep track of all these, and they are categorically understood by people of that time, in at least in the academies, very distinctly. And so you have min, who is a heretic, Jewish person who really leaves the fray for early Christian beliefs, messianic beliefs. That person, by the way, could still, in some way, shape, or form, be keeping some ritual kind of Jewish practice that you might consider to be things that, quote-unquote, only Jews do. But they might really have a different belief, or they might have been part of the groups that started a very much rejectionist trope of law, a more Paulist trope in the Christian world. and completely reject law and Pharisaic rule in terms of the buildup of rabbinic culture, right?
Min is a second word to the malshinim that we have in the Siddur.
Correct.
So why a malshin that wants to leave our cult and go elsewhere has an interest to go back and write our books? If he already made a decision to be against us in a way that he become a malshin, what is his interest to deal with our books?
Well,
I mean, this is a conflict of interest.
The reality is that throughout history, those who leave the fold of one religion, in the intellectual circles at least, let's talk about high intellectual history. Those who leave the circles or who are touched by the religiosity of others of faith that is kind of a brother or sister faith have deep interest. If it were not for Christian Hebraicists and not for the early church fathers, we would not have several of the books that were obviously Jewishly produced books, mm-hmm. 3rd, 2nd, 1st century BCE, in through the early period of canonization of the Tanakh. We wouldn't have them. And the same thing in the Middle Ages. Were it not for the desire of certain Christian Hebraists to preserve the early printings of, let's say, Rashi's and Radak's commentary, because remember, Rashi is with Radak on the page in the early Rabbi's Bible, the one printed first, Rashi's commentary, and then Rabbi David Kimchi is the one beneath him. If it weren't for the Christian Hebraists saying, please don't burn them, we need to understand the Bible, and this is very, very much nutshelling it, very much.
So those are the people that they will call them?
Yeah, so ironic, but so real. So real. Fantastic history of Beit Philosoph. We looked when we learned at chapter 16 of Shabbat that there's small houses for the study of philosophy. Wait a minute, they are rejecting, they're rejectionists. They reject the Torah. They reject Mishlei, the wisdom literature, maybe a little closer, maybe Ecclesiastes, maybe not. They're here. They're on the pages. There's maga. There's
discussion.
There's revelation through difference and otherness that comes out. Okay, so let's push forward. So here we have these two different scrolls. One's burned by the mean, one's put away, lignos, by the idolater. And Rav Nachman continues to discuss the legal status of the Torah scrolls that are found in possession of such people, but weren't necessarily written by them. Oh, now let me make a distinction. Found in your possession, but not written. Oh, if he's making a distinction about the ones that are not written, then we obviously see that there are some that are written. Nim sabiyad min, a Torah scroll found in the possession of a min, yiganez, that should be put away, that should be hidden away, that should be buried. Nim sabiyad of de kochavim, but one found in the possession of an idolater, amre la yiganez, some say it should be put away, meaning buried in the Geniza. Right? We had that before?
And some say Korin.
V'amre le Korinbo. And some say you read from it. So there you have it. They didn't write it. It's found in their possession. But now we use it. Now, Rav Nachman taught that the Torah scroll written by an idolater should be Yeganes.
That's right.
The Gemara should be put away. Should be put into the Geniza. The Gemara presents now three different brightas on the topic. What have we always said about brightas? Brightas are pretty authoritative, right? Brighta is that Tannaitic age text, the Mishnah age text that didn't make it into the Mishnah. It's that outside source pulled back into the discussion by the rabbis of the Talmudic era. Brightas have a lot of they have a lot of gravitas in the argument. They can generally come to trump Amoraic Limud. They trump conclusions by the generations after the Tanaim, which are the Amoraim. But here, listen to what, we have three brightas, and the three brightas seem to be a sugya in and of themselves. Sefer Torah Shekitavo Oved Kochavim, regarding a Torah scroll that was written by an idolater, Tane Hada, one brighter teaches, Yisarif, it should be burned. V'tanya Idach, and another Tanaitic teaching says, Yiganez, it should be hidden away, buried. V'tanya Idach, and I have yet a third brighter that says the following, Korinbo, you read from it. What do I do with these three different brachas that seem to say three different things about the Torah found by Oved Kochavim, by idol worshippers? Lo kasha. The Gemara responds, don't worry so much. I can tell you the exact situation that applies to each of the brachas. Don't concern yourself. No difficulty at all. Had Tanya Yisaref. The Tana of the Braita in which was taught it should be burned? Rabbi Eliezer he. That's Rabbi Eliezer. The Amar Stam Machashevet Oved Kochavim La'avodat Kochavim, who says elsewhere that the intent of an idolater is presumed to be idolatry. And if with the intent of idolatry someone writes a Sefer Torah, then I can't use it at all, because one of the great principles of writing a Torah is that I have to have the right kavanah when I write the Sefer Torah. I have to have the right intentionality. And if I'm the person writing it, I have to not only think that way, I have to do ritual acts in halakha of today that prepare me to write the Torah with the right intentionality. So what do I do? If I'm going to sharpen my quill, I have to say, L'shem mitzvat k'tivat Torah, for the sake of writing a Sefer Torah. If I'm going to write the name of God any given day on the Torah scroll, I get up, I go to the mikveh, I have to immerse. There are all kinds of laws today that grew out of the body of law that deal with writing Torahs. Now the Gemara goes on to the second Braita though. Remember the second Braita? The first one said it's burned. The second one says it's got to be buried. V'ha de Tanya Yiganez, and the Tana of this Braita, the rabbi of this one, the second one, it should be put away. Hi, Tanya who? Is this Tana whose view is recorded in that Braita? De Tane Rav Hamanuna Berei de Rava Mipashrunya? That Rav Hamnun, the son of Rava from Pashrunya, taught the following. Sefer Torah, a Torah scroll, now we're going to expand a little bit here, Tefillin Umizuzot, back to the Mishnah's expansion, Shekitavan, Umasur, Oved Kochavim, V'eved Isha V'katan V'chuti V'Yisrael Mumar Pisulin. They're all invalid. What did he say? He says, what about this second Braita that says that you have to what?
To bury.
Bury him. That is this Tana, Rav Hamnuna, the son of Rava from Pashrunya, who taught the following. A Torah scroll, phylacteries or mezuzot, that were written by a heretic or an informer, a Gentile or a slave, a woman or a minor, a Samaritan, or a Jewish apostate, are unfit, as it is stated. And here's where the pasuk comes in. As it's stated, Shenemar, he brings a proof text in this Braita, or in his limud, in his lesson. Ukashartem, uchatavtam. There's a verse in the saying of the Shema that says what? Ukshartam le'ot al yadecha, you shall bind them as a sign upon your hands. Yadecha, your hand, meaning your masculine, as the Gemara is reading it. Uchtavtam al mizuzot betecha, and you shall write them on the doorposts of your house, meaning the mezuzah. And from this we learn, and this is the way the rabbis learn sometimes, one comes after the other, right? First you had tefillin, and then you had writing of the mezuzahs. Kol sheyeshno vikshira, anyone who needs to put on tefillin, meaning Jewish men who are entirely Jewish and who have the obligation of the mitzvah aseh, of the mitzvah to put on tefillin, yeshno b'chativa, he may be permitted to write all of what we talked about being holy writings, that is, tefillin scrolls, mezuzah scrolls, and Torah scrolls. The whole she'eno v'kashira, and anyone who does not have the mitzvah, the positive obligation, to put on tefillin in the morning, eino b'chetiva, may not write a sefer Torah,
right,
may not write tefillin, may not write mezuzahs.
I don't think that that's what it's really in the end, because they can write, but we cannot buy it from them. That's the point.
We can.
Because most of Europe bought those books. Other people bought those books.
Ah, but we're not talking books.
I mean, they bought the Torah or they bought whatever.
We're not talking books. That's very important, by the way. Because in the time of the Rosh, in the time of 14th century, 15th century, 16th century, when books start coming on the market,
medieval,
you'll see that there's an entire discussion within Tshuvot. If you can read halachic responsa, like history books in some way, and there's a distinction made between scrolls and books that are printed.
No, I'm talking about scrolls. So those people who are not Jewish and wrote the scrolls, they wrote it to a different audience. They didn't write it for us. We would never buy them. For us, it's not kosher. But it doesn't mean that it was a business.
Right. You are talking about finding it by them at this point and those which were not written.
Right.
But in this case right now,
for us it's not kosher and it's not...
You have a different question now that comes into play.
Which
is the some of the broader issues that this entire chapter of the Gemara is dealing with. Who is not allowed to write, quote-unquote, our holy documents?
Right.
Right, and so, in this teaching, women are not allowed to write the Torah scrolls. And that, I wanted to just explore a little bit with some of what you can find in the world today, and what's going on around the Jewish world by way of Jewish women and the writing of Torah scrolls. It's a very interesting chapter now in terms of what you can find. So first of all, there's a College of Jewish Scribal Arts for Women. I printed out that which you can find on their web blog. So Fruit Nation, April 27th, 2006. The mission of So Fruit Nation is as follows. To help those Jewish women who wish to be fully empowered to form part of the very texture of our future's Jewish leadership, to understand that their life practices as a way of holiness supports this important role, the one and only mission of Sofrut Nation is the spreading of this message, and to those who grasp this ideal of holiness, this work offers the spiritual assistance and the halachic, musar, and kabbalist training which they need to practice Sofrut as humble community service. Its main activity is to give a fully halachic Sofrut training to its students. A Sofrut teaching agency which grants accreditation to those who fulfill the halachic requirements to become a certified soferet. So you'll see that if you go onto the site, there's all kinds of background that a person has to study. including some very modern books, so that there's a expansion of what one looks at when what one learns all of what one needs when she wants to become a soferet. And it includes everything that are considered halachic sources in classical places by way of what a person has to learn, including calligraphy and the approach to the writing of the letters, which has a very, very unique stylized kind of way of doing. And you see that there are manuals for this, and lots of different practice exercises have come over the ages. If you go to someone's learning soferut and wants to really become a sofer or a soferet, there's also theory, philosophy, and midrash listed on the site as to filling out your whole learning.
Can you give us the name of the site again?
Yeah, it's called Sof. You can find it at soferet.
Soferet.
soferet.wordpress.com. So that's there are some basic summaries of the arguments about whether or not women can write one kind of holy, either Torah, Tefillin, Mezuzah, or another. And there's also a discussion of Megillah, writing a Megillah in this one. There was piece written by Jen Taylor Friedman in the journal called Me'orot, a forum of modern Orthodox discourse. And her article is called Women's Eligibility to Write Sifrei Torah. It's really focusing in. And she'll go through and give you all the different kind of discussions, including quoting our page of Gemara as the classic locus for having this discussion. So I wanted you to see from this discussion comes right into modernity. This was written in 5768. So what's today? 5776. So 8 years ago. This was written in very much detail. And she goes through the historical reality of whether or not the Torah scroll retains the same place of importance or central use for study or just the public reading. And does that impact now the decision to allow women to do it? Because was it based on Rambam's exclusion of women from Torah study and therefore exemption from writing a Torah scroll, because the mitzvah of writing a Sefer Torah seems to be incumbent upon every person in the Jewish people? So do you want to require everyone to sit and do that? Is the positive way to see exempting women from any of those mitzvot that take a lot of time? Because they were so concerned that everybody would just be completely busied. But of course, what it does is it excludes her from Torah study and from writing, and up to a certain point, up into modernity, the whole debate about whether or not women are really involved in Torah study itself is alive and well, until the time that you get certain sources that simply seem to reflect a reality and an aspiration that women, of course, are studying Torah. And if women are studying Torah, and we do have sources that permit them to do so, then the reasoning of the Rambam seems to be put on its head, and women are now permitted and maybe obligated to write a Sefer Torah like everybody else among the Jewish people. So you have this wonderful discussion going on internet sources. This is Jen Taylor Friedman, Women's Eligibility to Write Sefrei Torah.
Thank you.
Did you have a question? What does Jewish law say? As Rabbi Harry Zeitlin says, the real question isn't can a woman write a kosher Sefer Torah, but rather, why has it taken so long for this new era to begin? Women's Torah Project. It's womenstorah.com. As with many things Jewish, there are many differing opinions and interpretations. Maimonides, a great sage of the 12th century, states that the purpose of writing a Torah is to study from it. The purpose of writing a Sefer Torah is to study from it. And then pardons women from the obligation of regular Torah study. Some have taken that pardon from obligation to be a prohibition. Rabbi Zeitlin and others disagree, since women today, even in Orthodox community, are allowed, if not encouraged, to study Torah. If women are seen as obligated to study Torah, then they might also be seen as obligated to write a Torah. Mm-hmm. However, even some sages who don't believe women are obligated to study Torah believe women can or must write a Torah, because some believe the obligation to write a Torah is independent of the obligation to study Torah. The mitzvot are given separately in the Torah itself. If the two mitzvot are separate, then women should be equally obligated to write a Torah. A number of sages base their understanding of the issue of women writing a Sefer Torah on a passage in the Talmud which contains a discussion about the status of a Torah scribed by a polytheist and quotes three opinions. Sounds familiar, right? Quoting our Gemara. Mm-hmm. It should be burnt. It should be stored away. It can be read from publicly if it was written with the intention of making a Torah. The second opinion quotes a teaching which mentions a number of other categories of people, including women. If these people wrote certain ritual objects, the object would need to be stored away. This teaching is based upon the juxtaposition in the Torah itself of you shall bind them, the tefillin, and you shall write them, the words on the doorposts. The Talmudic opinion therefore states that only one who binds tefillin can write. The question is, write what? The Talmud appears to be saying that the binding of tefillin is a prerequisite not only for writing tefillin parchments, but also for Sefer Torah and Mezuzot. Some commentators have interpreted it in this way. However, Tor, a major codifier of Jewish law, Rabbi Yaakov ben Asher, leaves women off his list of people whose Torah would have to be stored away. So when he codifies the law, she's not there.
She's impure or what?
No, she's not mentioned as one whose Torah you would have to store away. The Drisha, one of the main commentators on the Torah, here's your question, states that he believes the Torah left women off the list because he interpreted the Talmud to mean only that one must bind tefillin if one is to write tefillin, but not Sefer Torah. The opinion leaves a clear halachic opening for women, even those who do not bind tefillin, to write Sefer Torah. Some lay people argue that a woman cannot write a Sefer Torah because women are ritually impure due to other reasons, menstruation inclusive.
Right.
There are many arguments against this concern. The greatest is that everyone in post-temple times is ritually impure, and because we don't have the ashes of the red heifer to purify us, we can never become pure. And we've been in contact with corpses. And people have touched corpses. In addition, the Torah cannot receive ritual impurity. So this custom seemed to be completely against women.
Yeah, but
to write Torah, one or the other.
I'm not gonna.
It excuses women to write the Torah as well.
No, it opens it.
It opens it.
Absolutely,
yeah.
And that's what the Drisha said about the Torah's leaving her off the list. Today, I have a friend from the time that I was studying in Jerusalem who became a Soferet. There's another Soferet in the movement, in the conservative movement. There's not so many. I don't think the community of Sofrot has taken off in great numbers, but it's being discussed in halachically observant communities. You could call it modern, you could call it, you know, left side of orthodoxy, whatever you want to call it, and it's alive and well, and it's only within the last decade, and people are really trying to figure out where the future is for women Sofrot in our people, among our people. Okay, let's go back to the third part of the Braita. V'hadetanya, yeah? So I'm on 45b2 if you're in the art scroll on the left-hand side of the page. Third Braita. V'had Tanya Korinbo, and the Tanya of the Brita in which it was taught, you can read from it. Hi, Tanahu. The Tanya, that is this Tanahu taught in the following Brita. Lokhin Sfarim, mina ha'ovdei kochavim b'chol makom. We can buy Torah scrolls from idolaters anywhere. Uvilvad shehiyu chetuvin behilchatan. Provided that they are written in the proper manner. Does it say, by the way, that they didn't write it? Or does it say that they're written in the proper manner?
Yeah, but proper manner means you need to be Jewish.
Ah, doesn't seem to me to say that.
You need to have kavanah. You said that you need to have the...
You have to have kavanah. That may be the proper manner. But not for your idol worship. So can an idol worshiper, according to this Braita, possibly have the right intention?
Right. Yeah.
Or at least leave the intention for idol worship behind and write a Sefer Torah and write it in the proper manner, meaning what other possibility? I need to have the proper block letters.
Mm-hmm.
If you also recall from when we talked about the texts that needed to be buried right away or could be put into public circulation that appeared in Shabbat chapter 16 and Masechet Megillah, that we know that there are certain kind of script requirements at this point for the writing of the Torah scroll. Now, Umase ba'oved kochavim echad betzidom. And now let me tell you a story. Sometimes the Gemara will, even in a Braita, tell you, let me tell you what happened, mm-hmm. Now that I gave you that law. Shehaya chotev sfarim, he was writing Torah scrolls, Vehiti Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel likach mimenu, and Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel ruled that it was permissible to buy them from him. So, why do we mention Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel? Because he's one of our main legal decisors who's really created the principle of Tikkun Olam. And what is he saying about the relationship here with the non-Jew, the idol worshiper? That even if the craftsmanship was beautiful, if you had the wrong intention, you don't buy. But if it was done according to the halakha, to our rules, and potentially, as I'm reading it, more expansively and permissibly, and with the right script, then what are you allowed to do with it?
You're allowed to read it.
You have to use it.
But how does it apply to Tikkun Olam? Tikkun Olam.
Because here's where philosophically it's important.
How?
Because when you have... And here's the spark of it, I think, when you want to expand Tikkun Olam to how you relate to the others around you in the world. If there's any way to deal with creating a marketplace where you can have room to purchase these scrolls from the non-Jew, who does a beautiful, beautiful candelabra for Shabbos, you have such a silversmith,
right,
who creates the Judaica, but he's not Jewish, then maybe you're allowed. Maybe if Professor so-and-so, I'm thinking of one, but I don't want to name her, who's not Jewish, who's a head of a Talmud department, writes the book, maybe already the attitude here is, of course you read the book and respect her work, even though she's not Jewish. Maybe the kernel of Tikkun Olam vis-a-vis our relationship with others in the world, coexistence, is right here in the way that we deal with even our most sacred scroll. Maybe. Now, if you want to argue that the Mishnah itself sets it up where Ein Lokhin Min Ovdei Kochavim, we don't deal at all, we don't do business with non-Jews, you might be able to press that issue based on language in the Mishnah. There could be sagacious discussion regarding the relationship with anyone but the person who, what's the, if you will, the closest read of the text of the Torah that we can make to limit who really can write a Torah? What's the closest read we just encountered?
That everyone can write.
He who wraps tefillin.
That's only for the tefillin.
Is the only one who can write the mezuzah and the Torah. There's an extremely narrow read in this passage that if I was opining that way, let's call that small c, conservative legal approach, I could pull that out and I could say only the person who lays tefillin has the right to write the Torah. But then I could look at the overarching passage and the maaseh that's in the last braita that names Shimon ben Gamliel, who's seeking some type of overarching legislative action, legal action called tikkun olam. And I could read things much more expansively. And the fascinating piece on top of the expansive reading of the braita in apodictic form, meaning the code language, code law, codific law. The fascinating piece on top of codific law is the nomos, the narrative law, meaning there's a maase, there's a story. One time they were at this guy's studio, and Shimon ben Gamliel said, yeah, you can buy it, and you can read from it. And that narrative law, that nomos, that comes along with the very codific law, further proves the point of the Gemara in leaving the very narrow lesson of tefillin and Torah writing in the second braita and its interpretation, and comes with a third. Because my theory here is that if you bring me three braitas that seem to be in contradistinction one to the other in some way, and you bring me three, I'm going to push to actually figure out how I want to conclude this internal argument versus even when I have two arguments and the Gemara really keeps the tension between the first opinion and the second opinion. That somehow with three, there seems to me to be a potential opinion number one, potential opinion number two, resolution. That one, two, three implies in some way a deep resolution of the text.
But isn't that like different schools of Judaism?
It's very much possible that all the opinions here are about different schools and different Tannaitic households. But the editors, I'm more thinking along the lines of the editing of Gemara versus the schools represented themselves internally with the teachings, that the editorial process creates the culture, the real culture of the Bavli, the culture of the Babylonian Talmud, and then our understanding in a deeper way of the Tikkun Olam that's presented just up to that point. Now, that's not to say we read the remainder of what's written here, and we should, before we leave here tonight, so I'm going to push forward because we have a but, Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, Ibud Lishmevaye, but Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel requires that the hide for the casings of tefillin be tanned for their purpose. I don't know if you need the but, by the way, as the article says. It's an and, because we want intentionality to really be in place. Ketiva lishman lo baye, and yet he does not require the Torah scrolls be written for their purpose. That's the challenge. They seem to be challenging with that. D'tanya, for it was taught in a braita, tzipan zahav, if he coated them to fill them with a layer of gold, o sheshatla alehen or behema tmeya, or if he made their casings out of the hide of an unkosher animal, psulot, they're completely unfit for use. Or behema tahora, but if you made their casings out of the hide of a kosher animal, kshei rots, they're fit for use. Va'af al pi shelo ibadan lishman, and even though he did not tan the hide from which the casings are made for their purpose, with intent to use the hide for tefillin, Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel omer, Shimon ben Gamliel says, afilu or behema tahora pisulot. Even if he made the casings out of the hide of a kosher animal, they're unfit for tefillin. Achi avdan lishman, until they are tanned for their purpose. Amar Rabban Bar Shmuel says, Beger shechazar lesuro, when Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel said the Torah scrolls written by an idolater are fit for use. By the way, he was referring to who? Scrolls written by a proselyte who had reverted to his original ways. Such a person knows the Torah scrolls must be written for the purpose of the mitzvah. But that's only a limitation of a post-Rabban, you know, Rabban Bar Shmuel lesson. What I established again is that I have purpose and intention at the core of my argument from Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, right? I have the intention with the Torah making it fit for use. I have the intention with tefillin hide, making it fit for use. And so when I talk about casings and the hides of kosher and non-kosher animals and then making all kinds of, you know, fit for use, the object, then I can see that I have parallel because a Torah is made with kosher animal hide, right? And with the right intention or without the right intention. And tefillin are made from kosher animal hide, with or without intention. And ultimately I get to a place where looks like Shimon ben Gamliel is just making sure that the right intention is there. But the Gemara seems to have some trouble with that. At least Rabba Bar Shmuel has some trouble with that and limits it to a proselyte, to Ger Shechazar Lesuro, in other words, to someone who accepted into the Jewish community, but who left the Jewish community, but who still really knows what that the right intention has to be, mm-hmm. part and parcel of the writing of the Torah. The Gemara objects to the answer, Lesuro, you say that the reference is to a proselyte who had reverted to his original ways, Kol Shekain, but a Torah scroll written by such a person is certainly unfit to Chazele mean, because he's an absolute heretic. And we already included the heretic in the list of those who can't do it. Amar Rav Ashi, Shechozer Lesuro Mishum Yira, the reference is to a proselyte who had reverted to his original ways only out of fear, and since he was motivated by fear, we have no reason to assume that he's an absolute heretic. And therefore, I don't have to keep him on the list of people whose Torahs I can't use. And I can see him as a ger. I can see him as the convert who somehow still lives among them, but knows it deeply enough about the kavanah, the intentionality, and his art is obviously artful enough to be halachic, to be with the right intention, to be with the right script, if I want to get physical about the scroll itself, and I make room for that person who doesn't fit my category of solely the Jewish sofer who knows every one of my rules and laws. And that, in a certain way, is again Shimon ben Gamliel, the Tikkun Olam sage, creating for us another understanding of Tikkun Olam, the principle, and that is to expand it to these relations with non-Jews, not just those, by the way, who will kidnap and hold ransom, post the Mishnah that kind of intimated that, but with whom I might do business,
professional people,
even for sacred, artistically sound and beautiful clay kodesh, our holy vessels, if you will, our holy sfarim, our holy texts, that we need in our lives. And that's pretty powerful. So here's my show and tell. This is a drawer of various tefillin, so you see what we're talking about by way of the parchment and the different kinds of ways that they're put together. when people bring them in and they're no longer usable because they've lost their kashrut. There's lots of reasons why tefillin become unkosher. You could use them as all kinds of teaching, kaleen, all kinds of teaching tools. So this is a head tefillin that you'll see if I open this. Here's four different parchment scrolls in the head tefillin. That's why you have four different compartments. And I just take these, one of them out. So I can take any one of these out in the sense of thinking about what's written for these. So in the head tefillin, you'll have four different parchments written in expert hand.
Right.
This one's the Shema. In the third position in the head. And these are the kinds of small pieces of parchment that we're talking about when we're thinking about what are they writing? What are they forming for us? What kind of scrolls? And maybe a piece of it was indeed about who's literate and who's able to write and how widespread the teaching is. And who's artistic enough to do that? This is a...
So how many... You have four scrolls, so you have...
These are the head tefillin that have four.
Right. And
two from Exodus and two from Deuteronomy.
Okay.
And you can find in a Siddur the four passages in a traditional Siddur. In an arm tefillin, you have one long scroll.
Mm-hmm.
And they can be smaller or larger depending on the boxes. And all four are on the arm.
Same four is in the head.
Same four is in the head, but just all together.
Different font size. Mm.
Different font size. And I just thought you might be interested in seeing a smaller one. I don't know if anybody...
Didn't we look at these previously?
Yeah, when we study about the tefillin with Rabbi Wexler in the summer.
And the mezuzahs that we passed around.
Yeah, you want to see? You can come up and see if you like.
How do you write it? And then how do you read it?
Hold the end.
It's readable.
Yeah, totally legible. This one happens to be very beautiful. Maybe you'll send it around to everybody.
Yeah.
This one happens to be a beautiful ketav yad. Beautiful handwriting.
Why would it till it lose its kashrut?
So that's a good question. So, all right. So let's take these. These are so old, and they were what we call in the business bar mitzvah tefillin. I'm just gonna